from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. My four-year-old could have painted that. That's the kind of comment you're likely to hear in a modern art museum, and it's one that leads to the age-old questions, what is art and who gets to define it? Ellen Winter has spent her career looking at those questions from the perspective of psychology, studying the effect of art on our emotions and behavior.
Anything can be art. It can function as art, but that same object can function as non-art. The critical difference is how we respond to it.
Ellen Winter joins us to discuss her new book and what her research shows about how our brains respond to art, from visual art to theater, music, and literature, and that's coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. How do we decide what qualifies as art? And why do we devalue fakes, even if experts can't tell the difference from the original? And why do we seek out art that evokes strong, sometimes scary emotions in us, even when we run away from those emotions in real life? In her new book, How Art Works, A Psychological Exploration, Ellen Winter takes on the question of how humans interact with art. Ellen Winter is a psychology professor at Boston College. He's also director of the Arts and Mind Lab at Harvard, which focuses on cognition in the arts in typical and gifted children as well as in adults. And welcome, Ellen Winter.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Pleased to have you. In fact, delighted to have you. You get kudos from me, first of all, for raising, as a psychologist, not only some fascinating questions in your area of study, but also what I would say are generally philosophical questions. And one of them begins with the whole question of what indeed is art. And you're looking at maybe more what people think it is, an empirical question?
Yes. Well, psychologists have not tried to define art. Philosophers have tried to do that. And of course, aesthetics started out as a branch of philosophy, but now psychologists have gotten into the act. And since philosophers over the centuries have never been able to agree on a set of necessary and jointly sufficient features that might make something art, psychologists have asked instead, what are people's intuitive definitions of art? And do people agree? And is there any psychological reality to the concept of art?
Well, you say it's an open concept in many ways, and your book makes us grapple with so many things related to art. I had mentioned, for example, in the introduction, a forgery and the morality of, well, appreciating a forgery, because people like to have a purist view of art and don't think, like, a Vermeer has to be an original Vermeer as opposed to a forgery, but a forgery can be actually an extraordinary work in itself. Where do you get at the attitudes people have, for example, that play into this? They're singular, aren't they?
Well, we have been interested in why people disparage forgery. Why is it that when you look at a work of art that you think is by a Vermeer and you think it's fantastic and beautiful, and then you find out that it turns out to be a forgery, and all of a sudden your perception of that work changes? It's no longer as aesthetically pleasing, and you're not interested in even looking at it. There are various reasons why we might dislike forgery. One is it's not worth anything on the art market. Another is that it's immoral, and our moral judgment of the process may seep over into our evaluation of the aesthetics. But it turns out that even if you rule those things out, there's another reason why people are bothered by forgery, and that has to do with something psychologists call essentialism, the belief that certain objects have invisible essences of their creators.
That almost sounds mysteriously spiritual or something along those lines.
It's actually irrational. I mean, people will pay a lot of money for a golf ball that was owned by JFK because he touched it. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. We know it's irrational, but we want to own the celebrity golf ball and not the ordinary golf ball. And when people buy or look at a work of art by, say, what they believe is by Van Gogh, they believe they're communing with Van Gogh. They're thinking about the brushstrokes and thinking about the mind that made those brushstrokes. And if they find out they're actually at the museum in the Netherlands that displays the perfect three-dimensional prints of Van Gogh that are supposedly indistinguishable, they're suddenly not interested in the work because you don't feel like you're communing with the mind of Van Gogh. You're communing with a computer, and that's not as interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating. W.S. Merwin, one of my favorite poets, just died recently, and
yes,
he was asked, how do you judge a person's work, for example, a poem? And his response was, you can't really judge it. And yet we pretend in some ways, or we operate as if the mystery of art can be judged and evaluated, and we have that ability. And yet there are so many things that go into that. I've been a teacher of literature for many years, and I used to ask my students, why is a Rod McEwen poem not as good as a Wallace Stevens poem, you know? Why do you like Tom Clancy more than you like Proust? And the answers were always very along the lines of, well, that it's more accessible to me. The work that's considered less artistic or more inferior is more accessible to me, or I like it more. It speaks more to me. It becomes subjective along those lines.
Yes, well, I'm very interested in this topic also about whether people believe that their aesthetic judgments have any objective truth value. Of course, critics believe, maybe Merwin didn't, but many critics do believe that their judgments are objectively true. But it's very hard to demonstrate. The literary critic Helen Vendler at Harvard wrote that she can be very sure that one poem by Milton is better than another poem, but it's she doesn't know how to prove it to people who doubt it. What we've done is ask ordinary people whether they believe that their aesthetic opinions have any objective truth value. And over people say, no, we don't. It's just subjective. It's just what I like. It's just my opinion.
It's taste.
Then it's puzzling. It's taste, right? And de gustibus non disputandum, as they say, about taste one cannot argue. But then you actually can see people arguing fiercely over aesthetic tastes, even though they believe they're subjective. If somebody close to you says, I really can't stand abstract expressionism, and you love it, that really bothers you because your aesthetic tastes are part of your identity. Maybe not as strongly as your moral values, but they are still part of your identity. And so we do try to argue with people vociferously about differences in tastes, even though if you push people to the wall, they will say, I know it's just subjective.
It's nice to hear researchers arguing vociferously now and then. We're talking to Ellen Wiener, author of How Art Works, A Psychological Exploration. The criterion, the touchstone many people offer is universality. And you say what about that?
Well, some works of art seem to have stood the test of time. Over many centuries, they're still considered great. Think of the Greek sculptures or works by Michelangelo or Leonardo or works by Shakespeare. So they stand the test of time. They may not have been liked in the beginning. Many, many great works of art were first disparaged and are now considered great, like the Impressionists. So you could say that one definition of greatness is works that withstand the test of time and have a certain universality. Though I would add that we have not tested Western great works in societies which have been untouched by the West, so we can't be sure that if we went and played Mozart to a group that was completely isolated that they would suddenly realize that it was beautiful. That remains to be tested.
There's a lot that remains to be tested, as I've realized reading your book. But there's also, you know, some fascinating notions that come across, and very provocative ones, if I may say so, about how much art that's negative and can affect us negatively nevertheless has an impression upon us or an impact on us. I remember talking about Francis Bacon's paintings with Joyce Carol Oates, who has been charged with writing, you know, negatively for years or about violence, and who said, you know, I'm just writing about the human condition, I think, appropriately. But why people would rather, in some instances, internalize or even savor, as you put it, sadness or, for that matter, fear, terror in a work of art?
Yes. That is a paradox, and philosophers have written about it. Hume wrote about it. Aristotle wrote about it. Why is it that we willingly seek out feelings of grief and feelings of terror from works of literature or works of visual art or works of music when we try to avoid those feelings in our interpersonal lives? That is a fact. We do seek these out, and we do try to avoid it in our personal lives. And there have been a lot of theories about why. And some evidence. One piece of evidence is that it actually comes from Aristotle, and it's been borne out to be true. Aristotle said we like looking at the vilest paintings of the vilest subjects, like corpses of dead animals, because understanding gives great pleasure. So one explanation is that there's a lot of meaning to be had from negative art, and because life is filled with tragedy, and so it helps us understand the meaning of life, if I can be hackneyed, and that gives pleasure. Another explanation is that just knowing that it's a work of art makes you confront it with an aesthetic attitude and look at the formal aspects, which are positive and beautiful. There have been some studies on this, quite a number actually now in psychology, that show that if you take the same image and tell some people it's a work of art and some people it's, say, a science diagram. One study showed pictures of rotting food and dog feces. And one group was told these come from an art photography show, and another group was told these are images used to teach people about hygiene. People reported just as negative feelings in both conditions, but in the art framing condition, people also reported positive feelings. So the argument is that when people look at negative art, they have a mixture of positive and negative emotions, and the positive feelings come from either the formal aspects, the feeling that you're looking at art and therefore you're supposed to feel positive, or the meaning that you get out of it, which is pleasurable.
Yeah, the meaning is what has always struck me, especially since you mentioned Aristotle in the Poetics. You know, he talks about just coming to grips with the human condition in terms of tragedy and hubris and tragic flaw and all of that, but he also goes into some length about catharsis and what we experience in purging ourselves of fear or terror.
Right. I mean, Aristotle talked about how when we watch a great tragedy, we experience a great deal of pity, and the pity is felt because the hero is like us, unwitting, not evil, but somebody that gets trapped into some terrible, tragic circumstance. And we realize that we too could get trapped in those same kinds of circumstances, or maybe not the same kind, but other kinds, where we mean good, but something terrible happens and everything starts to fall apart. And that, of course, causes terror. And Aristotle did say that after the resolution of the tragedy, these feelings are purged from us. I believe there's some dispute in the philosophical world about whether he really meant that was the function of tragedy. But he certainly did say that the feelings are purged. And I think also the most important thing is that we connect to the human condition through thinking about this. We introspect about our own lives and connect to humanity and think about the meaning of life. And that is, as Aristotle said, pleasurable because understanding gives great pleasure. We're not just hedonists seeking to be entertained. We also want deep understanding, which is a more deep kind of pleasure.
Talking again with Boston University psychology professor Ellen Winner, who is the author of How Art Works, A Psychological Exploration. And you take in, Professor Winner, well, the visual arts, theater, literature, so much in the book, but each has experienced and can affect behavior in different ways. And one of the things, as a literature professor myself, I was struck by was you're saying, well, fiction may not make us more empathic, as has always been assumed.
Yes, this is something we always hear. First of all, we always hear it in general about the arts when people are trying to justify arts education. Kids need the arts because it improves empathy. Well, that
also,
sounds
excuse
good.
Me, it's supposed to improve their grades too, according to a lot
yes,
of research.
Yes, and that's another problem because that turns out to be bogus, and I'd be happy to talk about that if you'd like. I'll launch into fiction and empathy for a minute. People have claimed that fiction makes us empathic, and it's reasonable to think that because when we're reading fiction, we feel very empathic towards the characters. We can cry over the plight of characters. And by fiction, I mean theater, film, any narrative art. The question is what happens when we close the book or walk out of the theater? Do these feelings transfer to other human beings that we encounter, and does it change our behavior and make us behave more compassionately? William James, the brother of the great novelist Henry James, said that he worries about the Russian lady sitting at the theater weeping over the plight of the characters on stage while her coachman sits outside freezing to death. And there is some view in philosophy that we may well feel that we've expended our empathy in fiction and we've paid our empathy dues, kind of moral self-licensing, and then we don't have to do anything more because we've already shown that we're empathic humans. Now, I'm not saying that's true because the research on this is pretty weak. There is some research in psychology showing that if you read a story about somebody who's very good, you are more likely to do something good right after the story. The problem with this research is it's not using real literature, and it's testing very low-cost good behaviors. So I really believe we need to have much better research on the fiction-empathy connection before we can be sure that there is a link. I hope there's a link.
Well, it would be nice to think there's a link, but it would also be nice to think that there's a link of kids studying the arts and doing better academically, and there's this notion that if they listen to classical music, for example, they'll do better in mathematics, all those kinds of ideas.
Yes, I know. These things are all over the internet, and no matter how much I and my colleagues have tried to change the conversation about the benefits of the arts, these things keep popping back up. It started perhaps from the Mozart effect claims, which is that when you listen to 10 minutes of Mozart, scores on a spatial reasoning test rise compared to those who listen to 10 minutes of silence or a relaxation tape. It turns out that, first of all, scores go right back to where they were after a few minutes. And second of all, the whole finding has been debunked because it turns out it doesn't have anything to do with music. It has to do with being in a good mood. And when people are in a good mood, they do better on tests. If you think about it, why should studying the arts in school improve children's scores on mathematical standardized tests and verbal standardized tests? This is not what the arts are about. And this is not what they're trying to achieve. And if you look at an art class and you look at what kids are actually being asked to think about and do, it seems very disconnected from vocabulary tests and math computation. We've looked at the research on this kind of transfer claim that when you study the arts, you get better. This is a transfer claim that it transfers to your ability academically, which usually means standardized tests. And what we found is there is a strong correlation, but there is no causal evidence. So kids who take a lot of art classes in high school tend to have higher SAT scores than kids who don't take a lot of arts. That's correlational, and we have no idea what's causing what. If you look at the experimental studies where you divide people up into two groups randomly and they start out the same and you give one group a lot of arts education and another group something else like sports or computer education, and you look at whether their test scores go up, and there is no effect of the arts. So the only way you can discover causality is to do an experimental trial like that, and it just doesn't hold up. But that doesn't mean that the arts aren't doing any good. I'm a firm believer in arts education and value the arts greatly. And what we find when we study what kids are learning in the arts is they're learning big, broad, important habits of mind that are not the kind of thing that are picked up on tests. That they're things like learning to look closely, learning to evaluate, learning to accept criticism and respond to criticism because there are critique sessions in strong visual arts classes.
And learning to think
learning
critically.
Learning to muck around.
Yeah. And learning to think critically, yeah.
Learning to think critically, which is, we called it reflection, where kids are asked constantly to talk about their process. What are you doing? What are you trying to achieve? How are you doing it? And also, what's working and what's not working and why? And what could you do about it? And those kinds of questions are actually asked more often in art classes than in other kinds of classes in schools.
Well, you're asking some very important questions in this book, as I indicated earlier. And one of them is about perhaps the fact that maybe art doesn't affect us, make children, for that matter. A lot of people would be unhappy to hear that, more moral or kinder or more intelligent. But the experience of art, I think we're both in accord here, and many of our listeners are, no doubt, is very important and vital for children. So we can still advocate the arts and do. There's an epigraph in your book, in fact, from Mark Rothko, which I was struck by. Art is not about experience. It is an experience. And in many instances, I think that's what needs to be emphasized about the study of arts with children and, for that matter, ongoing through life. I wanted to ask you, though, about abstract art specifically because, you know, I've said earlier on that many people, my dad used to say, you know, a five-year-old could do those kind of paintings. And you talk mm-hmm. about your granddaughter, Olivia, you know, along those. What about this notion, for example, that abstract art could be done by children? And maybe we need to sort of think about how we judge skill in abstract art.
This is a topic that my lab at Boston College has been involved in quite a bit, and we've done about six or seven studies on this. We started out saying, wouldn't it be great to show that actually there's no difference between what four-year-olds can do and what abstract expressionists do in terms of ordinary people's perceptions? And the reason we wanted to show that was so great is because I think that the work of young children is extremely artistic, and there's something that gets lost after the preschool years. And we paired works by children as well as animals, elephants, monkeys, and chimps who have been given paintbrushes and paper and allowed to make marks on paper. We paired images by great abstract expressionists and either children or animals. And we paired them so that they looked as similar as possible. They were superficially similar. And we just asked people, which one do you think is better? And we also asked them, which one do you like better? And these are people that did not have any experience with abstract expressionism, as self-reported. And what we found is that people recognized the works by the artists as better. These were unlabeled. And then we – about significantly above chance. And then we presented them with labeled works. And half of them were correctly labeled and half of them were reverse labeled. And of course, it's not surprising that if they're correctly labeled, they're going to pick the one by de Kooning is better than the one by Elephant. But when we reversed the labels, what we found was very surprising. They overlooked the labels and went for the content of the work, and they picked the work labeled by Elephant, which was actually by de Kooning, as better than the work labeled by de Kooning that was actually by an elephant. People could actually see something in the works by the abstract expressionists that was better than the works by the children. And we tried this out a number of ways, which is by the artist and which is by the child or animal. How long do people look when they're making this comparison? We found out that people look longer at the works by the artists than the works by the kids and animals. We also collaborated with a computer scientist who taught a deep learning algorithm to make this distinction and then fed the algorithm new images. And the computer made the same distinctions that the humans did at the same level. It was always about two-thirds correct. And just the final thing I'll say is that we tried to understand what basis people are using to make this judgment, and it turns out it's the perception of intentionality. We had people rate these paintings for how intentional they looked without any labels on them. And works by artists are perceived as more intentional.
I thought that was fascinating. Yeah, I thought it was fascinating, particularly because I remember at the Tate Gallery, they made Blake-like engravings and paintings that were very much like the poet William Blake, but they were not Blake. They were made by computers. And people were somehow able to determine that.
Well, you know, there are now works being made by computers in the style of great artists. So there's a Rembrandt algorithm that can spit out new Rembrandts. And it's actually quite difficult to tell the difference. I've seen people be confused. The question is this a good thing? And do we? And if we know it's by a computer, do we value it? I personally am not sure it's a good thing because I think it's going to disrupt our understanding of art history.
But you mentioned art. I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
Oh, I just says in our studies we find that half the people we ask think it's a good thing because they can find more Rembrandts or more Hitchcock movies to watch, and other people think it's a bad thing because we don't want to watch something that was created by a computer because we like thinking about the mind that made it.
It's interesting though that you mentioned intention because there's something called the intentional fallacy by Beardsley and Wimsett, which says you really can't know an artist's intention. But we're coming up on a break here. We're talking with Ellen Winter. I want to get our listeners involved in this discussion, and lots of questions to be asked here. We want to hear from you. How do you define art? We're talking really about the whole realm of arts and art expression with Ellen Winter. We've raised a lot of questions here. I'm looking at a tweet by Bob who says, so is a painting by an elephant or a child really art? Isn't there a deliberate cause and effect in art more than just pleasing colors? Let's hear what you have to say, and I invite you to join us now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. You can join us now at that number, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website and posting any questions or comments you might have there, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Ellen Winter, who is professor in the Department of Psychology at Boston College, author of How Art Works, A Psychological Exploration. And indeed, she brings together a good deal of not only knowledge about psychology, but art and how the two really fit into cognition and how we perceive art, how we judge it, and how indeed we evaluate it. And these are big questions, and we're talking about music as well as abstract expressionism, figurative painting, novels, theater, really the arts in general. And what makes art good? What makes for a masterpiece? These are big questions, and you may want to weigh in here. And if you do, we welcome your phone calls and your emails. I'm looking, Ellen Winter, at a tweet from Craig before I go to callers here. It says, if Mozart puts one in a better mood and that helps when test-taking, that still seems pretty useful. And it puts to my mind something Nietzsche said about music, that that's really the purest form of art. That's what Nietzsche called pure form. And music does have a tendency to, bring our moods up or bring our moods down and certainly affect us in ways that maybe no other art does.
Well, I certainly didn't mean to say that if Mozart puts us in a better mood, that's not important. Mozart often does put us in a better mood, and if that's useful, by all means, use it right before you take a test. It's just that I don't believe that should be the justification for arts education for kids, because there's many more important reasons to study the arts. I mean, I think education should be about the most important things that the humans have invented, and those are the sciences and the arts. And the arts have been around longer than the sciences.
Really preceded the sciences, yeah. But would you say that music is really different in the way we perceive it and the way we respond to it?
Yeah. Because it's pure form.
Yeah.
I think music is a lot like abstract art. It's not representational. So it's puzzling how it is that we perceive emotion and feel emotion, but we do. And one of the clear pieces of evidence about why we perceive positive and negative emotions and feel positive and negative emotions when we listen to music is because music mirrors prosody in the human voice, and the same aspects of human voice that convey emotion, like slow tempo versus fast tempo, lots of pauses and irregularity versus regularity. Those aspects convey emotion in prosody, in speech, universally, as well as in music. So we don't have to learn it. We feel it instantly. And actually, people do feel more strong emotional reactions to music than they do to abstract art. And that's puzzling to me. But I think that all the evidence suggests that's true. Powerful emotions from music, when people look at abstract art, they don't talk about – well, some people talk about weeping, but most people do not cry in front of abstract art and do not feel close to tears and overwhelmed the way you may feel when you're sitting in a concert listening to music. One reason is because when people go to museums, they just walk right by really quickly. They don't look for a long period of time, and they don't get enveloped by it the way you do get enveloped by a concert. So the comparison may not have been done right.
Let me read a couple of comments that are coming in, some strong sentiments from a couple of listeners, and I want to bring them to the fore here. David writes, as an artist, I call BS on much of what is hung in museums. Artists and the art market are made and defined by curators, educators, auction house directors, and the like. These people are kingmakers and marketers with a good command of fancy words. And you want to respond to that, Ellen Winter?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. There's some art that I think is I can't say it's not art because it's in a museum. That makes it art. I don't particularly like it. I think we have to make a distinction between the art, non-art distinction and the I like it, I don't like it, or good and bad art. But, you know, if it's just made by kingmakers and making a lot of billionaires rich, it's probably not going to stand the test of time.
Well, here's Ron, who writes, in this time of inequality, why should society reward the intellectualism of visual arts when the compensation to my gardener who beautifies my town and home is compensated very little? Something to chew upon, and we'll go to our callers. Here's Chris, who wants to bring up Rauschenberg. Chris, welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Rauschenberg, just mostly because of his thumbing his nose at the art elite, but my favorite, what I want to mention and see if it's if it makes sense or something, a topic, is that there's a piece in the SF MoMA of a white, it's just a white canvas, two white canvases next to each other. And when I read about it, it's actually been recommissioned by his students to be painted. So he didn't even really paint it, or maybe he originally did. And my favorite thing to do is to stand next to the piece and listen to people try and understand it or describe it to other people, and especially docents. I love to listen to the docents try and describe it. That's it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for those comments. Yeah,
that reminds me of a YouTube that I showed my students by an artist named Robert Florjak, who hates modern art. And he said, I showed my students this image, and he presents an image of abstract art. And I say, tell me why, write me a paragraph on why this painting by Jackson Pollock is good. And his students write all kinds of complicated answers. And then he shows them that the painting was actually not by Pollock. It was a close-up of his studio apron. And he, of course, is trying to say there's no that abstract expressionism is a fraud, which I don't believe at all. And I think our studies about my kid could have done that, no, your kid could have not have done that, show that. But nonetheless, it could be kind of amusing to listen to people trying to make deep meaning out of art. Maybe the artist simply meant to say, I can say what's art. I'm an artist. And this blank canvas is art. And don't tell me it's not.
That's a difficult and in many ways vexing question, though. I remember talking about it with a few art critics. Jed Pearl comes to mind, for example. He used to be art critic of the New Republic. And you talk about a blank canvas and why that blank canvas evokes emotion, or why should it evoke emotion? For many people, of course, it doesn't. It's just a blank canvas.
I don't actually. Yeah, it probably doesn't. It's probably I doubt that it invokes much emotion. That's conceptual art. It's about one artist talking to another, talking to the art world about what should be considered art, and trying to constantly break the barriers down between art and non-art. And this is what artists do all the time. They're always messing with our concept of art, which is why I believe the art has to be an open concept, because artists are deliberately trying to keep it open, as opposed to a concept of flower, for instance, which is probably not an open concept. We can say what's a flower and what's not. And our flowers are not trying to mess with our concepts of flowerness.
Well, here's a listener who wants to talk about fetishism and art. Tim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Alan. Back in the 1980s, I studied philosophy of Marx, Engels, and the professor brought up a fascinating thing of fetishism versus use value. And he used an example. A lady in the room had a diamond ring, and he said, all the value we put into that ring is fetishism. Now, if we took the diamond out and put it into a blade and cut bricks and built a house, that would be use value. And so it was a Marx Engels type of view. Are you familiar with this? Fetishism, basically.
Yes. And I think what you're doing is drawing a connection between fetishism and my claim that works of art have artists' essences in them. And when we find out the artist didn't make them, it loses its appeal. I think there is something to be said for that. It is kind of like fetishism. It's like if you lose your wedding ring and you get it replaced and it's identical, it's not the same for you because it doesn't have the same symbolic value because of where you first put it on your finger. So it is in a sense this kind of magic feeling that these objects have special essences because of the time and place they were made. You could say it's connected to fetishism. It's a kind of magical feeling.
And we thank Tim for the call. We're going to go to more calls in a moment, but I'm going to go to a listener's comments coming to us by email. This listener writes, I'm not sure it's measurable, but I know that art saves lives since it saved mine. If I hadn't learned to discipline myself through creating art, I may have found a more unhealthy way of living. That's testimony. Yeah.
Well, I think testimony is important. Many psychologists don't believe testimony is important because they think that people can't know how things have really affected them. But I accept testimony. And I think what this caller is saying is that both the discipline of art and the meaning that came out of it gave her some purpose in life. And art is not the only thing that can give you purpose in life, but it certainly can give purpose. And I'm much more happy with that kind of a justification for arts education, that it can give purpose to children's lives, than I am that it's going to raise their test scores, which in fact, is not even true.
Talking with Boston University psychology professor Ellen Winter, again, the author of How Art Works, A Psychological Exploration. And here's Peter from Berkeley. Peter, join us.
Thanks for this show, because it's given me quite a good idea, I think, regarding promoting a public pledge or declaration to maybe let people read it on the Internet instead of just having it in writing. But I wondered if there was any objective research and your personal thoughts regarding the difference between, say, visual art and performance art, music and so on, which is kind of live there or original, versus the written word, which just has to be reproduced thousands or millions of times and so on. And I'm sure you've thought about that. Could you please share?
Yeah, Professor Winter.
Perhaps you're talking about the problem of forgery and reproduction. You can't really forge a performance, but if you take, say, a book by Dickens and you reprint it in many different fonts and many different publishers, it's still the same book. You can't do that with – it's still the same work of art. You can't do that with a painting. As soon as you copy it, it's not the original. So there is something about seeing the original – painting the live performance, which is very different from reading the written word And I think the closest you could get to the visual and performing experience would be to look at the original manuscript. And that's why people are so interested in original manuscripts. When people lined up to see the original manuscript of the Gettysburg Address, and when they had the opportunity to see a perfect facsimile, they had no interest. So it's the same feeling of seeing the artist's mind and hand at work up close.
And yet most artists will tell you that their work is influenced by other artists. It's derivative in many ways. It's maybe even has taints of plagiarism, especially when you get into literature. And I'm reminded of a student once asked me about The Wasteland, why don't we read the original instead of the version that Ezra Pound cut down so much that we're reading and studying? I mean, it's a kind of a desire for purity again. You know, people say Raymond Carver was edited by Gordon Lish, therefore his work has a kind of taint to it. It's not as pure.
Yes. And sometimes you might find a mediocre artist edited or altered by a greater artist, in which case it might have more value than the original one.
Indeed, often it does, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. If you take a Rembrandt and find out that the Rembrandt was actually half painted by somebody in his studio who was a lesser genius, then its value immediately goes down on the art market. And when you're looking at it, you wonder, well, was this brush marked by Rembrandt or was it by somebody lesser? I only want to look at the brush marks by Rembrandt.
It's an interesting comment from a listener named Noel who says, after I read a biography of Mark Rothko, I was more moved when I did see his abstract artworks. And here's a tweet from a listener who writes, we use music in our therapeutic beat-making groups with youth. Music, repetitive beats, and rhythms change brainwaves and can calm the nervous system. Also, music creates meaning and community. And back to author's intentions or artist's intention, Elaine writes, there was mention about artist's intentionality. There could be varied intentions. Could you talk more about intentionality? Ellen Winter.
Okay. There are three questions there. About the biography of Rothko making you more moved, I think that makes perfect sense because our aesthetic judgments and responses are very malleable based on what we believe about who made it. And when we know what happened to Rothko and how he was committed suicide, it actually may alter our responses. In terms of music therapy, music is used to calm people down who are sick. It's used in hospitals to reduce pain, and it's been shown to have that power. So music can be very powerful in medical situations, psychiatric and physical. In terms of intentionality, you mentioned the intentional paradox. Fallacy, thank you. It's not that people were saying, I understand what the artist's intention is. That's very difficult to do. And what people were saying and what we asked people to do in our study was just say, how intentionally made does this seem rather than accidental? How much do you think the artist was thinking and putting the mark there on purpose rather than having it just accidentally fall there? And that people can tell. I'm not saying that people can understand and guess what the artist's intention is. That is very unlikely.
Comment from
Bonnie. Unless the artist writes it out.
Yeah. Comment from Bonnie, who says, I had not been a fan of abstract art, but was moved to tears in front of a Jackson Pollock piece hung at the Tate Modern years ago. I have looked at this work differently since then. And let me bring some more callers on, which, by the way, actually suggests something else. People can look at a work of art or experience music or a work of literature completely in an utterly different way, depending on what passage or stage of life they're in. Isn't that true, Ellen Winter?
Absolutely. The more you know, the more it changes your experience.
But I mean almost antithetical, almost polarized, really, in some instances. But let me get some more callers on. And Tom, you're next. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. You got me, right?
Go ahead, Tom. It's not a great connection, but let's hear what you have to say and hope we can hear you.
I was wondering if the doctor is aware of R.G. Collingwood, a British philosopher. He wrote on aesthetics, and earlier you were talking about... Well, I guess it's all involved with intention, but he had two ways. He used film, movies, going into movies as a metaphor. You go in and see a film, you walk out, and you feel just the same as you did when you walked in. And the other way is you walk in, you see a film, you come out, and you're changed. And actually, your consciousness is raised. And he had terms for these two things, and I'm just wondering if the professor is aware of that.
Are you aware of that author, Ellen Winter?
Yes. Yes, and I think it's very important because great art is supposed to change us. It's not supposed to just be entertaining. Most people would believe that great art is something that should transform us, that should change our understanding of ourselves. There's some really interesting studies showing that when people look at visual art in a brain scanner, and when they look at the visual art that they have said is extremely moving to them, an area of the brain gets activated, which is called the default mode network, which is involved in introspection. And that suggests that when we look at art that we find profoundly moving, it causes us to introspect, which can change us. And of course, great, one person can be transformed by the same piece of art that has no effect on somebody else. There's a lot of individual differences in how people respond, and there's actually very little agreement among people on what they find the most moving.
I find moving a line in a poem by Adrian Rich called Planetarium, which you may know, about astronomer Carolyn Herschel. He says, "What we see, and seeing is changing." Always struck me. Always stayed with me.
Mm-hmm. Learn to see.
Excuse me.
And you can learn to see a lot more in works of art if instead of the usual 17 seconds that people spend in front of a work of art in a museum, you stare at it for an hour or two or three. I've had my students look at a work of art for an hour and write down everything they think and see and feel. They thought that it would be terribly boring, but they got into a state of flow and they realized that they experienced a great deal of thoughts, not so much emotions, but thoughts, and they saw more and more things in the work of art over time, which really argues for an extended look at art rather than a quick one.
What about the old idea that art should be, above all, in a paramount way, aesthetic, that it should indeed appeal to our sense of beauty, especially when we talk about art that does indeed evoke or involve beautification?
Well, that's kind of considered an old-fashioned idea now. The art world has rejected that they've rejected the idea that art has to be beautiful. If what you mean by beautiful is just plain sensorily pleasing, because often we have art that is grotesque because it's supposed to shock us and supposed to make meaning. So meaning has been put above beauty. But you could redefine aesthetic as something which shakes us up, gets us to think deeply, and transforms us.
I think it has been redefined in that way. I think that's pretty much with us now.
So I don't think people care about so much about whether something is – they certainly don't care if it's pretty.
Here's Eric. Eric, you're on the air with us. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to note and get your comment on the challenges of assessing art education when the inputs and desired outcomes can be so varied. And one example that comes to mind is with jazz. You might look at it from a music theory perspective, which is very analytical, almost like math. And then there's a technical aspect or the craft, which might just be hand-eye coordination and execution. And then an improvisation element, which might be completely anti-analytic and just about pure creative expression, and all of which can be affected by the approach of the teacher and how the student receives it.
Ellen Winter.
Yeah. What you're talking about is if you do a meta-analysis where you group a whole bunch of studies together and try to come up with an overall generalization, the problem is how similar are your studies? And that's why it's very difficult to do what's called meta-analyses. They say garbage in, garbage out. So you have to make sure you have good studies and that they're really uniform. In the studies that we did on transfer and whether there is such a thing as transfer from the arts to academics, we tried to group studies that were very similar. So we never put music and visual arts together, for instance. We looked at them separately. And, of course, if you're really going to take a close look at jazz, you're going to have to look at improvisational versus non-improvisational. You have to get the input, as you say, as close as possible if you're going to make any generalizations. We can only deal with the research that we have. And thus far, none of the causal research shows any effect on test scores, unfortunately.
Well, here's Lisa who says, what about art being a catalyst for children to unlock creativity and fostering new and different ways of thinking?
Well, this comes down to the kinds of habits of mind that we argue are the benefits, the real benefits of art education. And we don't use the term creativity, but we could have. We use the word stretch and explore, where kids, we went into one classroom that we were studying, and we heard the ceramics teacher say, today you're going to learn a new way of making two pieces of clay stick together. But I'm not going to tell you. You're going to figure it out on yourself, and maybe some of you will invent a new way. And, you know, if you think about that, that's kind of profound, because you don't really often walk into a math class and have teachers say, today we're going to come up with a new way of adding numbers together or doing long division. It's in the arts that kids muck around and learn by experimenting, and that's creativity. So yes, the arts can be taught in a creative way or an uncreative way, and anything can be taught in a creative way, but the arts are more likely to be taught in a way that involves experimentation and mucking around and self-discovery than other areas of the curriculum, unfortunately, which is why I think other areas of the curriculum could learn a lot from studio arts.
Again, we're talking to Ellen Winter. Her book is How Art Works, A Psychological Exploration. Here's a tweet from Catherine, who writes, what about inherently evanescent art forms like dance? Is an original company's performance perceived as more valuable than later iterations?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, what do you do with Balanchine? If you know you're watching a dance that was choreographed by Balanchine and it's exactly the way he wanted it, do you value it more than something that's been altered? My guess is yes. Because of our work on forgery, not that the alterations are necessarily forged, but my guess is yes, but that study remains to be done. What do you think?
Well, there's an effective brand name here that you're talking about, isn't there?
Certainly an effective brand name, yes.
The essence that you allude to, too.
Right. It's an effective brand name, but it's not just superficial like a Prada bag versus a fake, because you also know something about the mind of that maker. And we know that Balanchine was extremely original and a genius. And therefore, we like to think about how his mind came up with these moves.
Let me actually bring another caller on here. We go to Ann in Woodacre. Ann, welcome.
Good morning. I'm an art teacher to middle schoolers. And the way I've always taught abstraction, which I think is very effective, is that I show them a realistic painting and ask for the storyline, and they proceed to tell me what they think it's about. And then I play a piece of classical music or jazz without words and get their interpretation of that. And then we go to, I start with a song with words. They tell me that. And then a song without words. And then we go to a realistic painting. And then we go to an abstract painting. And they really get it. You know, they're smart. They want to understand. And I just think that those four steps take them to interpreting abstraction in a pretty easy way.
What do you think, Ellen Winter?
I think that sounds like a great sequence, getting kids to understand that representation is not the only thing that art does. Getting them to see the difference between a representational and a non-representational picture, and getting them to understand the difference between music with and without words, and to think about why, even without words or without representation, if it's an image, we can still interpret it and respond to it.
And then I thank you for that call. Yeah. And here's Robert. We're on the subject of art education again. Robert writes, too often people who love painting or drawing as kids feel discouraged or even frightened from sketching or painting for fun as adults, put off by fear of criticism or the sense that art is only for experts. And then he quotes, art for all now more than ever.
I completely agree that art education is often done very poorly in our schools. You know, kids under the age of about 6 don't really need any instruction at all. They have a natural instinct for creating art and simplifying forms. They don't care. They're not striving for realism, and their works are very charming. And they're not self-critical. But in the school years, they become self-critical. And I think it's the work of art teachers to fight against this. And it's a difficult task, but I think that we could keep the arts alive for kids in our schools, if we had the right kind of arts education where kids do a lot of discovery and they understand that interpretation and expression is more important than perfect technique. But often this is not what's encouraged in our schools.
Well, it's nice to hear from that teacher and what she's doing. And there are teachers like that out there. We need more of them. Here's Michael who writes, art reminds me of visiting historic sites. There's nothing like standing on a Civil War battlefield or visiting the Sir Francis Drake landing site at Drake's Bay to get a feel for what really happened there. And Jake writes, art is human mental play. We see something intricate and the right side of the brain takes it in, finds a variety of small stuff about the thing. Then the left side tries to fit it into its engine. The left side raises a bunch of statements or exceptions in the process of fitting it in, if it ever does. Just as animals have mock battles and hunts, humans also have a way of exercising our mental biology in a fun way. Well, as a psychologist, Professor Winter, I'm sure you know there's been a lot less emphasis through the years on left brain, right brain, but nevertheless, he brings up an interesting point here about human play, mental play.
Well, I do believe that art is human mental play. Art is play, play with meaning. But there's the right-left hemisphere distinction is very complicated because, if you look at literary art, the left hemisphere is heavily involved because you're reading. If you look at visual art, there's a lot of right hemisphere involvement because of the visual areas of the brain, but there's also analytic left hemisphere involvement. So it turns out that both hemispheres are always involved in responding to any form of art. But nonetheless, I believe that that art is a form of play. It's a very important form of play, and it's universal. There's no culture without it, and all human children do it instinctively.
Some cultures don't even have a name for it, though, as you point out in your book. But we're coming up to the end of this hour. I just have to ask you, any current or new research project that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, actually, what I'm thinking about is the fiction empathy problem. And I am trying to design a program of research to study whether fiction about particular moral issues actually alters people's views about those moral issues. Because I think it's unlikely that fiction makes us more generally empathetic, but it may make us more specifically empathetic about what we've read about.
I'd be anxious in every sense of the word to see the results of that work. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. It was a delight to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Ellen Winter's book, How Art Works, A Psychological Exploration. Thanks for listening to Forum. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.